Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
This message comes from our sponsor, Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC Health/whatsyourwhy.
Today, my interview is with Dr. Carson Williams, a facial plastic surgeon of CW Facial Plastic Surgery here in Kansas City. He's become a bit of a friend over time, and he has also done surgery on myself personally, a functional surgery. Anyways, we go into many topics today. He is board certified in both otolaryngology and board certified in facial plastic surgery. We talk about peptides, chemical sunscreens, Botox, both of our personal regimens of Botox. We also talk about microtrauma to the skin, microneedling, salon grade microneedling versus other microneedling. We talk about peptides. We also talk about blepharoplasties, eyes, ears, noses, baby ears, including what he thinks of what I did with one of my children's ears and what I didn't do with one of my other children's ears. So join us today. There's many other things, including lasers, topical caffeine, and TMJ. But hopefully you take away a lot. This is a good high-level overview of everything to do with the face, and hopefully we'll have him on again in the future.
Welcome back to the Gillette Health Podcast, where we give you tools to develop a balanced approach for health. I'm Dr. Kyle Gillette. This is my guest today, Dr. Carson Williams. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. So in my personal journey for both improved functional breathing and also, in my own aesthetics practice, people know that I've always been very interested in aesthetics. I used to cut and color hair for fun. And I know that, you have similar interests. I guess, how did you get involved in the aesthetics, plastic surgery business?
I suppose like anyone going through a surgical training field, it was a bit of an evolution for me. It really probably began early with some exposure with my mom's father, who was an oral surgeon, and he used to have his own operative suite in a wing of his own home. And so he was long since retired by the time I got interested, but I used to love to go in there and play with little surgical instruments and kind of pretend. And that just kind of snowballed. And then I got into medical school and I was like, what do I want to do? And the head and neck was always of the greatest interest to me. And so I pursued an ear, nose, and throat residency training. And there's about four or five kind of subspecialties within ear, nose, and throat, one of which is facial plastic surgery. And I just glommed onto that. I found it to be fascinating because I could offer people this wide breadth of care from cosmetics to functional, to reconstructive, to trauma care, cancer care, and everything in between. And I just really gravitated toward that. And so I did an additional year of subspecialty facial plastic surgery training and now practice that entire scope.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. I guess in the context of desiring an improved health span, better quality and quantity of life, Why should we care about aesthetics?
I think it's a built-in motivator. I think vanity, to a degree, a healthy degree, mm-hmm. is extremely healthy and important. Whether you're 7 years old, 70 years old, whatever the case may be, whatever station in life, I think having at least some vanity is helpful to motivate you to be the best version of yourself. Mm-hmm. Health goals, financial goals, trying to get a raise, trying to, you know, get promotion at work, changing careers, whatever the case may be. Mm-hmm. I think if you put your best foot or maybe face forward, then you really can be the best version of yourself. So I do think it mm-hmm. matters mightily.
So facial aesthetics is like a different flavor of bodybuilding, mm-hmm. but arguably safer.
Maybe. If you go to the correct providers.
Depending on what pharmacology and treatments you're leveraging for both of those things.
Sure.
And I guess you can make a case, I guess for bodybuilding, a lot of people draw the line at, you know, when it's a medication, supplements, even if they're not particularly safe, they're okay with. Mm-hmm. Where should the average person think about drawing the line? Do they just dip their foot in? Where do most people go down that line?
I think the dipping the foot in is probably most people's entry point into this realm. And I think mm-hmm. that's probably the most reasonable thing. Most people are starting to dip in at a younger and younger age as this overwhelming, I don't even want to call it a trend, but it's actually an important trend, for lack mm-hmm. of a better term, that entry into this at an earlier, younger age is so much more powerful than it is until waiting until you're already showing those classic signs of facial aging to mm-hmm. then try to jump in and correct significant age-related changes of the face, head, and neck. Mm-hmm. So I think dipping in slowly with non-invasive or very minimally invasive things is mm-hmm. absolutely the way to go. And much of this can be done without the use of even seeing any sort of a plastic surgery provider. And so a lot of it is available over the counter. A lot of it is available through prescriptions from any provider.
Are you talking about sunscreen?
Sunscreen's hugely important. I would say that is probably the foundation on which everything else is based. Mm. Sun damage is the greatest contributor to aging. And with simple daily protection, you can help hold off those changes mightily.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense. I'm thinking about my personal regimen. Mm-hmm. When I get a significant amount of sun exposure, I do try to use sunscreen. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm in the ocean, then maybe I try to use a barrier or a reef safe one.
Sure.
And I know there's tinted sunscreens. There's, you know, prescribed only sunscreens. Mm-hmm. So I use that. And then I use a little bit of a botulinum toxin. Mm-hmm. I've tried that for my scalp. I don't think I'm a responder to that. Mm-hmm. I also use a little bit for my face. Mm-hmm. And people ask me about it. And, you know, I don't know if we're exactly in the same boat. But there seems like this, and I had this perception before I started dipping my foot in as mm-hmm. well, that if I got something like Botox, I'd have to be frozen plastic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely not.
Yeah. What would you recommend for some people that want to prevent aging or even just prevent sun damage or damage due to androgens that they're on that's mm-hmm. androgenizing the skin? Is there kind of like a general place to start where somebody should think about getting botulinum toxin or should they do PRP under the eyes? Or what would be an average regimen for someone that's interested in getting into it like myself?
Sure. I think the best place to start is with things that can be acquired and used at home without seeing someone like myself. And that's may sound counterintuitive. That drives business away.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately that's the more logical approach to it. So a fairly simple routine that is not a large investment of mm-hmm. time, money, energy, what have you, is probably, if you think about it on a full day routine, twice daily gentle cleanser, mm-hmm. twice daily moisturizing of the skin. Maintaining a high degree of hydration is very, very important. Yep. Sunscreen every single day. And many times now for like foundational makeups for women, they will have a pretty high degree of sun protection factor in there. Mm-hmm. Many times it'll be over 30. Hmm. And if it's not in the foundational makeup products, it'll be in the moisturizers. So mm-hmm. you can kind of kill two birds with one stone. But I absolutely, even if you're in a low sun exposure area, far away from the equator, or maybe like the Pacific Northwest, when it tends to be a little bit cloudy all the time, mm-hmm. it's still imperative. It's about cumulative exposure over days, months, and years. It's not just about, oh, I got one sunny afternoon and I forgot to wear my sunscreen. Mm-hmm. It's the drive to work. It's the sitting in the sunny office space. Mm-hmm. You're getting that exposure at all times, so you need to have it on. So I recommend SPF 30 or higher for daily use and SPF 50 or higher when you're in actual sun exposed activities with constant reapplication. About every mm-hmm. 90 minutes to 2 hours when you're out in the sun, you should reapply those high SPFs. Mm-hmm. So then to take it a step further beyond the SPF sunscreens, I also think things like retinols are very important. Those are vitamin A derivatives, and they cause an increase in cellular turnover of the skin. Mm-hmm. It increases texture and tone and thickness of the dermal layer of skin, therefore giving it a more youthful appearance. Mm-hmm. And then a couple of other adjunctive things. Hyaluronic acid is a kind of a broad topic, but hyaluronic acid serums improve hydration of the skin. Mm-hmm. And then you can also do things like peptide serums, vitamin C, caffeine-based. Those are a very long thing, and that would probably be my last choice to add mm-hmm. as a daily regimen. But cleanser, moisturization, sunscreen, retinols, those core products are hugely helpful. Mm-hmm. And it's not an overnight fix. It's 9 to 12 months in the making. So if you start today, in a year, you will reap massive benefits. And maintenance of that will pay dividends. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I tell people for hair as well. It's almost mm-hmm. like hair comes from the skin, and that's why things tend to lag behind 9 months.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. It's got to go through the appropriate cycles
of
growth.
The life cycle.
Yeah.
Some people ask about the peptides. So I assume most of those are hexapeptides. There's a lot of other peptides, which are kind of niche, and I would definitely mm-hmm. agree those are not first-line skincare items.
Yeah.
Some people also ask us about chemical sunscreens, mm-hmm. regardless of what ingredients are, you know, approved ingredients or whatnot. Mm-hmm. Do you see potential concerns coming up as evidence continues to come out about, you know, potential concerns with chemical sunscreens, or is like the dose mix the poison?
I'll be honest with you. I think that the risk that chemical-based sunscreens expose you to pale in comparison to the risk of sun-induced skin cancers and sun-induced damage to the skin. I think with everything in life, eating a cheeseburger has a risk.
Yeah.
You know? But if it's done appropriately, logically, and in moderation, I think that it's a risk that is worth taking, so to speak.
Yeah.
So while it may expose you to some, I think it's minimal, and that the greater risk is mm-hmm. not using those things.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you have the opportunity to buy more natural-based ones or mineral-based ones that don't expose you to those, that'd be great. But just like anything right now, it's going to cost more. It's going to be a bigger investment, but it very well may be very much worth it.
Yeah. Another thing that people forget is things like nitric oxide are mm-hmm. also carcinogenic.
Yes.
So, if, you know, people spend a lot of money on supplements. They do a lot of things to increase nitric oxide, mm-hmm. like exercise. So the dose makes the poison for nitric oxide and other potential carcinogens as well.
Yeah.
Same thing is kind of true in the, I see a lot of parallels between the skincare, you know, makeup, sunscreen, mm-hmm. et cetera, and the concerns with artificial sweeteners mm-hmm. or low calorie or non-nutritive sweeteners.
Yeah.
There's a lot of potential concerns with, you know, are they carcinogenic? Are they leading to other outcomes? And you're not looking at it in a vacuum. You're looking at it as an alternative, usually, to sugar.
Sure. Absolutely. I wanted to circle back real quick. You asked a little bit about botulinum toxin and mm-hmm. kind of its usage and role. you kind of highlighted a really important point about frozen versus natural movement.
Yeah.
And we can talk more about that at some point. But I think also the usage of things like botulinum toxin or a broad classification is called neuromodulators is consistent usage of those products has been shown in research trials to have a very objective improved appearance of the skin when used over time. And one of the best studies that I've seen is a side-by-side comparison of identical twins. Mm. And it was two women, I believe they were in their 50s, if I'm not mistaken. One twin had used botulinum toxin regularly, 3 to 4 times per year.
Sounds about right.
For about, I believe it was an 11-year stretch. The other twin had used it once over an 11-year stretch.
Yep.
They had very similar sun exposure. They had similar everything else. And they put them side by side and did skin analyses and pictures. And the change was remarkable, or the difference was remarkable. Yeah. The one that got the botulinum toxin looked easily 8 to 10 years younger. Mm-hmm. And just refreshed, looked well rested, looked, you know, just better. And the way that I explain that to my patients when they're talking to me about neuromodulators, is it a good choice? How does it work? Is it really worth investing in over the course of years? Is simply just to think about taking a crisp sheet of construction paper. If you fold that paper once, that crease in there isn't that set. Mm-hmm. It'll settle. But if you take that same piece of paper and you fold it in half hundreds or thousands of times, that crease will stay there permanently. I don't care if you take an iron to it, you will still see that crease.
Yep.
So the analogy is, if you have been injecting botulinum toxin over the course of time, you are preventing that folding happening mm-hmm. in the skin, like of the forehead and the glabella. It's not creasing it. So over time, those deep righteds or wrinkles are not forming to the same degree. And therefore, you have a younger, more youthful appearance of skin. And so, yeah, it is an investment, but it absolutely pays many dividends mm-hmm. down the road and along the way.
Yeah. I usually inject about 15 units. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, the units are different for Dysport and Xeomin and Botox, but for either Botox or Xeomin units, I usually inject about 15 in my glabellar lines, which is the one big muscle there, procerus, I believe, and then your lateral corrugators.
That's correct.
And then usually about 10 to 15. And I don't self-inject because from my experience cutting hair, I am never as good. I mean, if you've self-injected, I'm not going to judge you, but
I self-inject.
I don't self-inject because when I cut my own hair, I do cut my own hair.
Yeah.
I do not do as good of a job. So I'm like, you know what? I'm going to let somebody else
inject. Fair enough. Me.
But that's generally what I do. I've also heard don't inject crow's feet unless you're going to kind of treat everything else in general. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a huge fan of the jelly roll or whatever they call it. And in general, I'm not a huge fan in treating other areas of face unless there's a very specific reason. I don't know what your thoughts are on my regimen that I've come up with so far.
I think you're very much thinking logically about it. And I think a very easy way to think about botulinum toxin injections of the face, especially the forehead and the area around the eyes, mm-hmm. I like to think about it as a game of tug of war.
Yeah.
And let me explain what that means. There is brow elevating muscles and brow depressing muscles. Mm-hmm. There is one brow elevator, the frontalis muscle. It technically has two bellies, one on each side of the forehead, but effectively there is one brow elevator that pulls mm-hmm. the brow up, gets your eyes open, doesn't make you look tired and grumpy. There are five muscles that pull the brows down and inward. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, the procerus in the midline, the lateral corrugator, and then you've also got, so that's three, and then you've got your orbicularis oculi muscles, mm-hmm. so the circular muscles that surround our eyes. When you're doing botulinum toxin injections to this area, you need to balance those things mm-hmm. to achieve the best result. Now, some people like when they get little bunching over here.
Yeah.
That's perfectly fine. You can do that. But with logical injections of the glabellar area, the lateral orbital rim, the lateral brow, you can get a little bit of a lift, especially in ladies many times like that, so they don't have to arch or shape their brows as much, and also get really good softening across the forehead without freezing anything, without getting undue what is called ptosis or descent of your brows, and really making it look like a naturally rejuvenated area. So through the game of tug of war, I think you can get very good results. And what you have done for yourself or have done to yourself, I think is a very good regimen. I think the number of units, if we're talking, let's just use the kind of archetypal Botox or Xeomin.
On label, I believe is 20 units just in glabellar.
Correct.
See?
And it's different for everybody. It also depends on how soft or frozen you want those muscles to be.
Yeah.
My glabellar muscles, I'm not injected right now. I need to get going again. But mine tend to be very robust. I get a lot of bunching in this area. I have to do about 30 units up in that area to really get the result that I like. Mm-hmm. However, as emotive as my forehead is, I only have to do about 12 units total for my forehead.
Not bad.
And so the frontalis muscle is quite big and robust, but it doesn't need the same paralysis as many of the other brow depressors. And in general, you want these to be softened, but you also want these brows to elevate up so you look well rested and awake and youthful. So it is, and when I counsel patients and when I do inject patients, I say the same thing to everybody. It is, especially if this is your first time, go low. So if you
exactly what I say too.
If I think you need 20 in one particular area, let's start with 10, 12, 15. See how it goes for a couple of days. If you love where you land, we leave you there. If you're like, I love it, I want more, you can always stack. The problem is, once it's in, it's in. And then it will take those anywhere from about 2 to 4 months on average to dissipate back away and wake back up.
I think that's a great summary.
Yeah.
So that's good to hear about the neuromodulator, the Xeomin or the Botox, whichever brand people are using.
Sure.
Another thing that I like to do personally that I'm getting into is, micro trauma to the skin. My friend Derek from Channel More Plates More Dates, he has a non-salon grade microneedler. Here we have a skin pen. We do vampire facials. Back in the day, I did try to do it to help my beard come in a little bit, actually.
Yep.
And then also to help with my problem spots in the hair, which is actually mostly my crown.
Yeah.
And I'm not as good at doing that as I should be, but how should people think about keeping their skin rich with collagen and elastin?
I think the best idea is a fairly comprehensive approach. We kind of talked about the recommended daily routine and kind of a consistent and long-term plan for neuromodulators. And I think those play a massive role. So I'll kind of repeat again, a daily routine of high quality skincare is very, very important.
So daily microneedling?
Not quite. Nobody's got time for that. But I do think something like that plays a really important role. So the daily routine, the maybe 3 to 4 times a year for neuromodulators based on how much longevity one gets out of their injections. Collagen stimulation like you're talking about. Now, there's a couple of different ways you can do that, but micro trauma to the skin, specifically to the dermal layer of the skin, through things like microneedling, laser resurfacing, or injectable what's called polyalactic acid, which is something, the brand name is Sculptra. It all helps to stimulate collagen that is already within those structures. It kind of tells it to wake up, go to the gym, bulk up, and it gives skin a thicker texture and tone to it, which just has a much better feel and appearance to it. I think it goes another step further. I think that people need to think about a comprehensive regimen as these either non-invasive or minimally invasive techniques. But I do think if someone is fully committed to this, they should consider surgical intervention as part of that regimen. Mm-hmm. But the analogy that I use for my patients when they consult with me is I think you need to think about all of this stuff kind of similar to the way in which maybe dental care is. And I know yep. that sounds a little weird, but hang with me. The daily brushing and flossing mm-hmm. is like getting your skincare regimen under control, doing the retinols, doing the hyaluronic acids, doing mm-hmm. the good sunscreen. That's every single day. Your regular scheduled cleanings that are occurring every, whatever they are, 4 or 6 months, that's yep. kind of equivalent to your neuromodulators, your Botox, your ZMN, your Juvo, whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe some dermal filler if you're looking for a little volume addition. I think the next step up is like, you need a crown, okay? Mm-hmm. That happens intermittently, not all that often. So maybe that's like your yeah. collagen stimulators, your mm-hmm. Sculptra, your microneedling, maybe a laser resurfacing. Mm-hmm. But then there's the dental implant
yep.
or the big root canal or the whatever that maybe only happens once or twice in your life. Mm-hmm. That's equivalent to the rejuvenating surgical intervention that someone like myself can also offer in the form of be it facelift, neck lift, brow lift, eyelid mm-hmm. surgery, ear pinning, whatever the case may be, mm-hmm. to really round out that whole comprehensive approach. And so I do think they should be kind of stratified like that. And usually if someone is committed to it, they will go through those progressions over the course of time. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's a really good way to do it.
What's the difference between a brow lift and a blepharoplasty? So if someone just... You know, if you just genetically tend to have a lot of sagging mm-hmm. to where it's hard functionally to see.
Sure, sure. So blepharoplasty is eyelid surgery only. You can do upper blepharoplasty or lower blepharoplasty, or you can do them all at the same time. Sometimes we refer to that as a quad blepharoplasty because we're doing all four kind of quadrants. Mm-hmm. A brow lift, on the other hand, addresses the position and somewhat also the shape of the eyebrows. And those have to be accessed from a slightly different way. The biggest or the most popular way to do it in the vast majority of patients is through either a temporal scalp approach where we can enter in the hair-bearing skin to completely conceal the incision. Yep. And an isolated temporal brow lift really just only addresses the outer half of the brow to get it up and stabilized in position and somewhat alter the shape. Mm-hmm. You can also do a minimally invasive endoscopic approach to brow lifting where we also make temporal scalp incisions, but 2 to 3 other additional small access incisions mm-hmm. and have the assistance of a camera underneath the skin to elevate those tissues, bring them up to whatever position we would like to put them in, and then we can fixate them in place through a variety of techniques that are outside the scope of this talk. Mm-hmm. So that is really important though, and that's why a consultation with a specialist is so important, because so many people come in and say, I want my upper lids lifted or an upper blepharoplasty.
Yeah.
And they very well may benefit from that. But then you take a look at them and their brow is sagging down into their eyeball, basically.
Yes.
And you ask them, if you just simply lift that up, does that look better and feel better? And everybody says, yes.
Yep.
Many times they still need a little more conservative upper eyelid lift, if you will. But it's reduced mightily. Mm-hmm. And doing the two in combination is so powerful. Mm-hmm. And the results are so excellent.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think if people get Botox injected very heavily in all other areas except have a permanent spock, is that going to make things sag more or less?
I don't think it has a significant effect on things overall. I think brow ptosis or the descent of the brow is age and genetically driven more than anything.
See it, genetics runs in families, pretty hardcore.
Absolutely. I mean, I tell them you picked your parents wrong if they've if it's basically a 30-year-old who has very heavy upper eyelids.
Yeah.
It's a little on the lower or younger age range, but yeah,
kind of like hair as well.
Yeah,
like 90% of 80-year-old men will have significant androgenic alopecia.
Sure,
but a lot of 30-year-olds do too.
Absolutely, there is no age cutoff for this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of surgical candidacy if it's a surgical case, and what are they bothered by?
Yep,
and what are they looking for outcome wise? And that's just where a sit down with someone like myself can really reveal to these people what is the best option for them or what the options are that they can kind of choose from.
You also mentioned ears. Mm-hmm. So I've talked about ears before and how I've used ear buddies in the past and people have asked about ear splints, and there's all sorts of different things. And it seems like some of them work wildly better or worse than mm-hmm. others. And it's really kind of a kid's thing.
Sure.
But yeah, I guess, how late's too late if somebody genetically happens to have ears that tend to be a little bit asymmetrically rotated,
sure.
like in my family mm-hmm. And myself? Like, how should they approach that, both for themselves and for their kids?
Absolutely. Timing is probably the single greatest component of that, and mm-hmm. the earlier, the better. So ear reshaping, sometimes we call it ear molding, is a very powerful technique to help a young child's ears form into a more kind of normal or natural shape mm-hmm. and regain better symmetry side to side.
Yep.
So I provide a service called Earwell Ear Molding, and it's a company out of the Chicago area that developed this non-invasive system. It uses adhesive to stick to the side of the head around the ear with what is called a cradle. And that cradle then has small little retractors and formers that mm-hmm. are able to kind of snap into position to give shape to the ear exactly as you want it to be shaped. Mm-hmm. And then it all clips together. It stays adhered to the side of the head for a matter of anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks. And we change that out periodically. And it's a beautiful thing because it's totally modifiable. Mm-hmm. I can make it exactly what I want. It doesn't hurt the child at all. Yeah, they have to wear this little thing on the side of their head for a while, but it's a tiny blip on the radar in the grand scheme of things. And so timing, though, is hugely important. It is most effective if these are applied to the child by 3 weeks old, which is very early. So early that people have already missed the boat because maybe a pediatrician or their family practice provider who's providing the pediatric care may not either be aware that these things exist, which I've been trying to spread the word. But also what I have found is here where we are located, we have a very large referral children's hospital.
Yep.
And everybody assumes that they must provide this service. And so they'll get referred to this large hospital.
Yep.
And by the time the referral is processed and they say, oh, we actually don't do this. And then they send them to me, which I'm very fortunate that they think of me.
Yep.
Sometimes it's too late.
Yep.
And so
I can see that.
3 weeks is most successful. Depending on the circumstance and the physical examination, I will definitely go up to 4 weeks. The latest I've ever applied was 6 weeks, mm-hmm. and I told the parents this is going to be a Hail Mary attempt.
Yep.
Don't expect a lot. And sure enough, we got very minimal change and improvement. And that really comes down to the really accelerated maturation or maturity mm-hmm. of the cartilage in a young child's ear in those first days and weeks of their life. The earliest I've ever applied was the second day of life.
Yeah.
So they literally saw me very soon.
I feel very validated. The earliest I've applied is the first day of life.
Yeah.
In Springfield, Missouri, with my first son, mm-hmm. I had those ear buddies, which is very similar. It's basically like a wire that you can bend very slightly.
Yes.
And it's probably not as good as whatever you use, but at the time, it's the best I had. And then adhesive, mm-hmm. I would have had a better something to take the adhesive off, like an anti-adhesive, mm-hmm. I would have had a better one of that. That is my main downside, because my wife hated it when I did it, because mm-hmm. taking the adhesive off, at least for these ear buddies, was not as painless as your method. And she did not want to do it for our second son, mm-hmm. and he has very different ears.
Yeah. And so I think that's a good segue is there anything else that can be done for this stuff? And the answer is many times yes, but it's a matter of when. And so if there are some congenital deformity of the ear, I think the first thing that's important to note is with these ear molding and reshaping methods we're talking about, all of the normal parts and pieces of the ear, they need to be present in order for these things to be successful. So if a child is born with a significantly deformed ear, or what we call microtia, or in the most severe circumstances, anosia, the absence of an ear, these things will not work. It's not geared for that. So all the pieces kind of need to be there, but they just may be in a little different shape than we're accustomed to seeing or want to see.
With my first one, it was an elf ear.
Yeah.
So there's no folding up top. It was just kind of straight like that.
Kind of pointed at the top. Sometimes the cartilage is very prominent. And instead of being a concave curvature, it's a convex curvature.
Yep.
And simply just popping it the other way will correct that ear.
Yep.
And just it's held in position for weeks at a time.
That's exactly what happened. And
so
can't even tell now.
Yeah. And sometimes they do grow out of a minor little deformities. My first child, my daughter, she had a pretty significant pinch at the top of her ear. She was a preemie baby, so she was in the NICU. There was a lot of other moving pieces. Mm-hmm. We kind of missed the boat on her, and we said, well, we'll just deal with it later on. And thankfully, it has completely unkinked, and I couldn't even tell you which ear it was anymore. I don't remember. But if people do miss the boat, I don't think it's a reason to totally lose faith that their ear is going to be significantly deform for the rest of their life. But the timing of when intervention may then occur is important. So if we don't do it right away, the next point in time that it would be reasonable to do anything to an ear would be around the age of five. And the reason for that is the ear is about 80% full size, fully developed by age five.
Wow.
And it's almost 100% by about age nine. Wow. So before they're in, what would that be, fourth grade or so, their ear is basically full adult size. It does still continue to grow a bit, but it's pretty much there. And the reason that's important is because if you were to try to surgically intervene with a procedure called an otoplasty to change the ear, too early, the ear is still maturing.
Yeah.
And therefore, your changes made may not be permanent.
Yep.
So you want the ear to get to a point where it is settled mostly into its final form and size before you intervene. It's relatively convenient that around age five is also the time when kids generally start school. And the reality is the social stigma comes from usually people at school.
Yeah.
It comes with these deformities.
Fortunately, I was homeschooled.
Yeah. There you go. Didn't have to worry about it.
Is it the same for noses? Or how does timing and progression matter for that? Because it's also cartilage.
It is. It's cartilage and bone. And it's really important to consider the age and maturity of the patient at hand. So we facial plastic surgeons and anyone who performs rhinoplasty type procedures, we're trained that you should be fully mature or so close to it before you do modification maneuvers to a nose. So in girls, since they tend to become adolescents a little earlier and complete that process a little earlier, the general recommendation is the youngest age is 15 for a girl, and the youngest age for a boy would be about 16.
Okay.
Now, those are loose guidelines. They can certainly, you know, some 15-year-olds are a lot younger than 15 and a lot older, if you know what I mean.
Yep, for sure.
So the exam is important and that discussion is important. But those are the general age cutoffs. The youngest I've done a rhinoplasty was age 15 in a girl. The youngest in a boy, I believe, was 17, just kind of the way it shook out with timing-wise. So I think those are important, though, because the cartilage is still growing. The growth plates that are within the bone of the nose and the septum and the nasal bones are still growing and progressing and changing. So we haven't met steady state if you're age 12 or whatever. Trauma changes that trajectory. If you've unfortunately broken a nose or car accident and whatever the case may be,
yeah.
Sometimes we do have to intervene a little earlier and we just have to deal with the circumstances at the time. But 15 for a girl, 16 for a boy are the general guidelines.
For those who don't know, what's the difference between rhinoplasty, septoplasty, cases like mine, where really a lot of it was breathing related?
Absolutely.
I guess what's the definition to those things?
So plasty means to change or to modify. So that suffix on a word simply just means to change or modify. Then the first portion of that word means what structure are you working on? So septoplasty, one of the most commonly performed surgeries in this country, is to modify or change the shape or position of the nasal septum, which is effectively a vertical wall on the inside of the nose that separates left and right nasal passageways. Most people have a deviated septum toward one side or the other, or sometimes a bidirectional, which just means it kind of goes back and forth. And it causes narrowing of one or both of those nasal passageways. And with a relatively short, anywhere from 20 to 40 minute procedure, we can modify that septum through an internal incision and get people breathing better in a matter of minutes. So septoplasty is a functional case, which means that we are not changing the appearance of one's nose with that procedure. So septoplasty, being a functional case, is covered by insurance. Rhinoplasty can be either. Rhinoplasty can be functional, cosmetic, or both. And the two are not mutually exclusive. Form and function follow one another. So rhinoplasty means we are either wanting to change the appearance of one's nose. Common complaints are very large bulbous tips of the nose. Maybe there's a large hump on the nose. Maybe the nasal base is too wide. Maybe the tip droops, or what's called a ptotic tip. We can change or modify many of these things. Conversely, a functional rhinoplasty is when someone comes to me and says, "Doctor, I don't mind the way my nose looks. It's fine. I just can't breathe." And there's a whole number of different problems with the nose that make it a poorly functioning piece of anatomy.
If somebody has functional issues, for example, breathing, and they also want to improve the aesthetics, would you recommend that they seek out a specific facial plastic surgeon or someone who's also boarded in ENT like yourself? Or can they just go to any general surgeon that does plastics?
I think I'm certainly biased. I think that facial plastic surgeons specifically have a vast understanding of not only the way a nose should look, but the way a nose should function, because the vast majority of we facial plastic surgeons have gone through an ear, nose, and throat residency training first. So we get the core fundamental training of how a nose should work functionally and a significant amount of aesthetics of a nose. And then we go on and do additional focused subspecialty training on everything about noses and faces. So I think that we tend to do it really, really well. That being said, some of the foremost experts on rhinoplasty are general plastic surgeons, but they have really generally honed their focus on one or two procedures. And I think that's like anybody. If you do it enough times, you do enough repetitions, you get enough practice and exposure, you become better and better and better. So I think it's definitely worth people to do their due diligence, do their research, never be shy about going on a second or a third opinion visit to find the surgeon that meets your desires and needs the best.
Yes.
There's a nice segue with what you're asking, you know, if they have functional issues and maybe a cosmetic concern.
Yep.
In my opinion, you should take care of both at the same time. Mm. But there's two buckets there. The functional aspect is covered by insurance. If you're simply maybe taking down a hump on a nose, there's no functional reason to take a hump down. So there is also kind of a cosmetic aspect there that those are self-pay portions. But because you're already utilizing an operating room with general anesthetics and whatnot, many times the price out of pocket would be relatively lower for someone to do those as combination cases. I kind of think about it like a subsidization.
Yeah.
You're already utilizing the service in the room and the anesthesia. You don't have to take on as much of a hit financially if you choose to do them both at the same time. So I do generally recommend that. That being said, I think it's important to note that I don't know of a single one of my colleagues, and myself included in this, if we are doing a fully cosmetic rhinoplasty, we still address the function. We never want to walk out of that room with a poorer functioning nose than when we entered it. So if the septum needs to be straightened, if what are called the valves need to be addressed for support, if the turbinates on the inside of the nose need to be reduced or repositioned, those are always done. Even though we're not focused on the way it works necessarily, we would be doing the patient a massive disservice to make them breathe worse just in the sake of getting a better looking nose.
Do you think they do that in other countries too? Because I know people travel and they'll look for surgery because sometimes it's at greatly discounted prices in some cases.
I would like to say surgeons are all good and only focused on the benefit of the patient, but in many places outside of this country, they're focused solely on quantity, not quality. And so they do half measures in order to simply make a nose maybe look better, and they completely ignore the function of it and sometimes many times make it much worse. Mm-hmm. Or they're using synthetic implants, which are a terrible idea. Don't ever put something that is not your own body in your nose. Things like Gore-Tex or Teflon or plastic or whatever. It is a very, I just saw two patients in the last month, both of whom had rhinoplasty performed outside of this country with plastic implants on the dorsums of their noses, one of which it was completely extruding or pushing out of the skin as a foreign body reaction. And the other one is on the verge of that. So it's a really big problem. So yes, other countries sometimes don't have standards that are as high as they are here.
Yeah.
And it can be risky. However, there are some places in this world that perform some of the best rhinoplasty anywhere. Namely, Turkey has some of the best.
Same thing for hair transplant.
Absolutely. You literally see planefuls of men with bandages on their head coming in and out of
Turkey.
Exactly. So I think it's, again, it's just a matter of you need to do your research, you need to do your due diligence and find someone who you trust and also has their credentials to make you confident that they can get a good result.
How about other cutting edge or bleeding edge treatments like Kybella, the chemical that ACDC, whatever, it's not AC, that's the band, PCDC, chemical is that just melts away fat.
Sure.
What's the like safety profile of that?
I think the safety profile is fine. I don't feel the same way about the outcomes of it. Mm. So Kybella is what is called deoxycholic acid. It is a bile salt that is present in all of our bodies. I believe it's in all mammals, but don't hold me to that. But it's definitely present in humans. And its job is to break down fat particles. Mm-hmm. And so Kybella was engineered and brought to market by Allergan Aesthetics. And it is an injectable form, and it is intended only to be used in the submental area of the neck, so under your chin, for those fat pads that exist. I have injected it before, but I have stopped offering it. And the reason is not safety related. It is, I am unimpressed with the final outcome of actual fat reduction. I am unimpressed with the downtime that comes with it.
Yeah.
It comes with a significant amount of initial swelling.
Yep.
And it makes eventual corrective surgery much harder because it has induced a lot of scar tissue formation in those areas. And then the final piece is price.
It's extremely expensive. It's even the compounded stuff, which I would never touch personally.
Yeah.
As someone who uses compounded medications, I would not use compounded Kybella.
I agree completely. Prices differ wildly across the country. However, in our current market, our local market here, the price for Kybella usually meets or exceeds something like cervical liposuction.
Yep.
That is a permanent solution, a one-time procedure, whereas Kybella is anywhere from 3 to 6 sessions over the course of many months. So basically, you are getting it all done in a matter of a 30 to 60 minute liposuction session many times, which can be done in the office under local anesthesia.
I like that a lot.
So it's, I think it's just a more direct way to do it that's equally, if not more, safe. And you just don't have to put the people through what is ultimately a more expensive and a higher downtime deal. So safety, I'm not terribly concerned about it. As long as you're using it under the official recommended uses here.
Okay.
There's some off-label if you want to do some in your midsection down here, whatever, love handles. It can be used there too, I'm sure, very safely. As far as I know, it is not approved for that use.
Before someone would consider something like a little lipo, is there a specific amount, like let's say they're at 50% body fat. Do you give them a body fat percentage goal or a weight goal or just like a general fat loss goal before or after
the lipo? Whether it's liposuction or rejuvenative surgery like face and neck lifting, our general recommendations for patients are to be within 15 to 20 pounds of their ideal body weight. So if you want to be, if you think 200 pounds is a healthy weight for your body, just as an example, I would want that person to be anywhere from 185 to 215 before they would pursue a procedure. Because neck and facial fat tends to be very stable within that range. So it's about a 30 pound range plus minus. It tends to be pretty stable. I think it's also of note that adiposity or fat deposition in the neck, especially in the immediate submental area, there's a high degree of genetic component there. It's not because you ate too many burritos or cheeseburgers or whatever. And I think I'm actually a decent example of that. I have a relatively robust fat pad here. I'm not in the best shape ever, but I'm also not significantly overweight. It's mostly a genetic thing. If you looked at both of my parents, they have the exact same thing. And so you have to, again, you have to examine these patients closely and have those discussions with them and figure out, is the fat under the skin? Is it a deeper fat pad under what is called the platysma muscle? Because all of these have to be treated differently.
For sure.
And Kybella cannot treat subplatysmal fat.
I wouldn't imagine so.
Cervical liposuction also cannot manage subplatysmal or under the platysma, deep to the platysma fat. And so you need to have a good evaluation because you may have liposuction or Kybella or whatever and still have significant fullness there, but the problem really wasn't in that immediate under the skin fat. It was a deeper layer that's more inaccessible unless you do more formal open surgical neck lifting.
I don't know what you think of topical caffeine creams. I've been kind of underwhelmed by them, but I do think there's some potential. I don't know if you think that the evidence is enough for like topical theophylline, like aminophylline cream or the glycerinic acid or even GH frag, the AOD9604. I mean, some of the studies seem relatively promising, accelerating fat loss by 2 times. But then again, 2 times 0 is still 0.
I'll be honest, it's not something I've delved into very much. And so I think some topical caffeine creams and whatnot are decent for under eyes and some of the the pigmentation and the tightness of that. But when it comes to fat, it's not something I have really seen in my literature very much. So it's something that I would like to learn more about. But
kind of between bleeding edge and cutting edge.
But
I mean, the good thing about it is it's small enough molecules to where penetrates into the subcutaneous adipose. So getting into the area is a good start whenever you're thinking about a topical treatment. I guess that's a good transition into exosomes, perhaps PRP. We've touched on, we've mentioned vampire facials and whatnot.
It's a great adjunct.
Other trends,
PRP is a great adjunct. I think just in isolation for the face itself, I think it leaves a little bit to be desired when it comes to just refreshing the area. But I think if you're already inducing a micro-trauma to the area and allowing that penetration to occur. It's similar to aerating your lawn and immediately putting down seed and fertilizer. It's able to get into the layer in which it's actually affecting change.
Yep.
So vampire facials by microneedling, inducing the injury, and then covering the area with topical PRP, I think is a great kind of supercharger to the treatment. I think it's wonderful. The flip side is true for hair. I think hair, PRP in isolation for hair restoration is actually really good. It just bathes those areas and those growth factors that are so needed for hair restoration that it does really tend to help. You can certainly also do things like microneedle in that area and also PRP as well.
For sure.
Exosomes are something that I will fully admit, they sounded like complete voodoo to me.
Me too.
For a while.
Yeah.
I'm still in the stages of my own research and coming to grips with a comfort level of when and if I will offer those to my clients. Mm-hmm. I have not done so yet. I was at the Global Aesthetics Conference in October of just this last year. I listened in on a couple of talks from some leading experts in facial cosmetics, and I was pretty impressed with what I saw. First and foremost, the safety profile seems to be excellent. There does not seem to be any safety concerns, best I could tell. And then when I saw what it was able to do for people who underwent things like laser resurfacing, and then they would immediately have exosomes placed, they would do kind of side-by-sides, they did tend to have better results.
Yeah.
And a quicker recovery too. That was impressive. The, the quickness to re-epithelialization, to reduction of redness was much faster than without it. So it's definitely something I'm looking into more. I think that it's been kind of a flash in the pan so far.
Yeah.
So I do think it's in our best interest as providers, and it's definitely in the best interest of the consumer. Again, due diligence.
Yep.
Make sure that the company or the provider you're working for has done their due diligence in high quality, high researched products that carry those safety profiles and have the science to back it up. So
definitely.
There's a lot of emerging companies with this stuff, but I'll be honest with you, the big players are probably always going to have the budgets to provide the research and development that is, in my opinion, necessary to bring good products to market that are safe and effective.
Yeah, so. That's a great summary. We've very recently added Benev exosomes, which between us and our good friend, Alec McCarthy, their regenerative medicine PhD, we have tried a lot of different ones, you know, to see if the preliminary data, again, a lot of the research on exosomes is very recent, pans out, and it is starting to. And with Benev, I am quite confident that they get them from a source that I am comfortable with, because they get exosomes from stem cells, of course. And you want to, like, presumably, if you care about this, from placental or potentially umbilical cord stem cells, and not from stem cells that come from other places.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you want to offer a product that doesn't carry any potential controversy.
Yep.
I think consumers don't want that. I don't think you tend to have people on one side of the aisle or the other that are pursuing these things. They don't even want to think about it. And so I think if you have something that comes from a good source that's non-controversial is the best way to do it.
For sure.
And it's got to be high-powered too. So.
A couple things that we're kind of excited to use with exosomes is as an adjunct to add on. You know, a lot of times we'll use hyaluronic acid or GHK copper peptide or hexapeptides, which is in kind of your over-the-counter peptide products, most of them. But we recently got our salt facial in, which is phototherapy, cavitation ultrasound, I don't think we've touched on. Then, of course, exfoliative devices. I guess you mentioned a CO2 laser, but...
That's what I currently offer.
For someone who's new, or maybe they've just done hydrofacials or, you know, regular exfoliative facials, where should they think about adding something like that in, if so?
I think it's a really great idea. And kind of to go back to my dental analogy, I think it's something that can be done maybe once a year, or maybe even a couple of times a year. I'm going to speak from the thing I'm most familiar with, and that's the laser resurfacing. The hydrofacials and the salt facials are overall very minimally invasive. I think they're more kind of, many times spa-like treatments give you that kind of refreshed glow. They'd be great to do before a big event because there's really no downtime whatsoever with most of them. Mm-hmm. The things that I offer tend to have a little bit more downtime associated with them, but the result tends to be pretty powerful, and it's all relative.
Yep.
The more downtime, the bigger the result. So it's always a trade-off.
Yeah,
so
you generally don't go to a facial plastic surgeon and want just a little bit of something. I mean, sometimes you do. I would, but I imagine
what everybody
a lot,
wants.
Yeah, a lot of your clientele are probably expecting a mega result.
Everyone wants the mega result with the minimal downtime, and those are mutually exclusive.
Yes.
You know, I think a colleague of mine said, you know, if you want minimal downtime, it's going to be a minimal result. You know, everyone wants maximal result with minimal intervention, and those two just aren't quite compatible. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's always our goal is to have people back up and at them as quickly as possible with as little physical and social downtime as possible.
Yeah.
But those things have to be balanced when we go into these consultations and then ultimately choosing what we do. So to kind of talk a little bit about resurfacing for what I do. So I use a carbon dioxide fractionated laser. It's a device by Qtera, which is it's definitely one of the big leading brands out there. Carbon dioxide laser specifically targets water molecules within the skin. Mm-hmm. And when the laser strikes water, it specifically only targets that, and it vaporizes the water on contact. Mm-hmm. What that does is it produces heat within that area, and then ultimately it induces collagenesis and helps to reorganize. And it also improves pigment, specifically brown pigments. Mm-hmm. So on my laser, I can turn the settings down very, very low, and you can effectively do a laser facial. Hmm. It's very minimal. You can do it with no to very little topical numbing. There's very little downtime. Call it a glow up before a gala or something like that. It would be something great to do a couple of days prior.
I forgot to do that before my gala two weeks ago.
Darn, you should have called me. You can then ramp it up again a little bit. Like, for example, I just had a 20-something-year-old young lady who has beautiful skin. It's just she has a lot of brown speckled pigment that is bothersome to her. It's not melasma. Melasma is not well treated with lasers. That's a much more hormonal condition. Mm-hmm. But it's just a lot of brown speckling, and she's bothered by it. So we did one session about 6 weeks ago at a low setting. I then just did a second session with her about a week ago, at a slightly higher setting, and it's been remarkable, the change.
Yeah.
And she did that with just a little bit of topical numbing, no additional sedation, super well tolerated. And downtime was, I think it was 4 to 6 days of some redness, pinkness, and then it eventually flakes and kind of scabs and falls away. And all that brown pigment is basically just falling off of her face. Mm-hmm. Those are super light settings. The other end is also possible. I can turn that device way up and really deliver a lot of energy. And what that does is it damages the skin considerably more in a controlled fashion, but it induces a much more robust dermal response for collagen formation. Mm-hmm. And it also effectively scrapes the entire epidermis off, allowing new epithelial cells to activate and resurface the entire outermost portion of the skin. And it either eliminates or significantly reduces the appearance of fine lines and even some of the deeper set wrinkles in people's faces. It helps to reduce the depth of acne scarring, if not eliminate it entirely. And it helps to reduce pore size as well, all of which gives people a much more refreshed appearance. Mm. Now, in those settings, some people are not tolerant being awake because it's fairly intense. However, a lot of people are. I usually will just have topical numbing on them for anywhere from 1 to 1.5 hours prior to the procedure. They just bring in a book or a magazine and read for a while this stuff sits on their face. I've also started introducing some what are called anxiolytics, so basically things to calm your nerves,
yep.
along with some oral sedation and oral pain medication, all of which are on board
in order to
hopefully have the patient as calm and sleepy as possible.
Seems like a good idea.
Yeah, and so what I've done is I've definitely started to develop kind of a protocol. So if you're going to be doing any of those higher settings, it's an automatic thing. You got to have a ride. You're getting oral sedation and some pain medication so that it's most comfortable for you.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Is something like a Morpheus or a radio frequency microangular, whether it's monopolar, bipolar, would that be analogous to like a medium setting on this, or is it completely different?
It's a little different. Microneedling is not addressing the epidermal layer of the skin very much. It does a little bit if you're using non-insulated needles. It's mostly affecting the dermal layer of skin. So laser is doing a little bit of both. The little columns and channels are penetrating down into the skin more deeply. Yep. So that's affecting change in the dermis while passing through the epidermis and allowing, you know, damage to occur there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Monopolar versus bipolar, microneedling. Morpheus is probably the industry leader in this. Theirs is a bipolar device. It's phenomenal. It's a very good device. It has very good outcomes, but it's a little different. I would say the feeling of it is probably analogous to a medium setting on the laser when it comes to kind of a little bit of discomfort along the way. But they are kind of treating some different things.
Yeah.
And again, I like to put things into analogies for people who don't understand our world as much to understand. I think that microneedling is, like I said earlier, it's like aerating your lawn.
Core aeration.
And putting fertilizer and seed down in those little plugs.
Yep.
That's microneedling. Whereas if your lawn is in total shambles, you just take a scraper and you
scrape. It's got a lot of mole and vole hills, bumps and lumps.
Exactly. Kind of looks like my lawn right now. You just take a scraper to it and you scrape the entire upper layer of grass off.
Mm-hmm.
You put down all new sod or seed and you allow that to grow back in. That's more analogous to the laser.
Yeah.
You're scraping that whole upper level while still affecting change deeper.
It's almost like there's an individualized regimen for each person, depending on their unique characteristics.
There absolutely
is. You can't just do a cookie cutter regimen for each person.
You cannot. You can't. I mean, all of these machines, some of the lower end ones are things that are done at maybe like med spas and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They have like setting 1, 2, 3, or 5.
Yeah.
Or 4, 5, whatever. Mine has infinite.
Yep.
Infinite settings, up, down, whatever I want. A couple things to note. Microneedling in general can be performed on anybody of any skin tone. Laser cannot.
Hmm.
At least not my laser. And most resurfacing lasers like erbium, ND-YAG, CO2 are not to be used in darker skin pigmented individuals.
Hmm.
Because the risk of hyper or hypopigmentation is too great. Also, the darker the skin pigment becomes, in general, the propensity for things like hypertrophic and keloid scarring go up significantly. And so at that point, the juice is not worth the squeeze. There is a scale called the Fitzpatrick scale of skin pigmentation.
Mm-hmm.
The general accepted rule is anyone who is a 4, 5, or 6, which are the darker skin pigments, are ineligible for laser resurfacing and tread carefully with 3s.
Yeah.
So it is what it is. It's just the characteristics of how these things work and propensity of skin to react to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the lighter skin pigmentations do better with some of these classic lasers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of emerging research on other types of lasers or a laser device that actually applies 2 separate types of lasers kind of simultaneously. Some of these are gravitating into darker skin pigments, but you still need to tread carefully.
Yeah.
Very much. But microneedling does not matter.
Well, we will tread and laser carefully then.
Absolutely. It's the best thing to do.
So I guess now that we've talked about a lot of the skin aesthetics, we get a lot of questions about TMJ and jaw hypertrophy. Things will grow the bone.
Mm-hmm.
But I know I've talked to you in the past about master hypertrophy versus atrophy.
Sure.
How can we translate that to the general population?
I think just a definition of terms is important. Yep. First, hypertrophy simply means enlargement of the muscle. And in this case, we're mostly talking about the masseter muscle, which is a big, it's like a leather belt type of a muscle that runs from the upper kind of cheeks down onto the bottom portion of our jawbone. And its job is to close the jaw in a very powerful fashion. So growth of that muscle can be, you're born with it. You may have a very bulky one that generally gives fullness out kind of in the lateral portion of the cheeks and over the what are called angles of the mandible down here. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of width in that area. It can also be somewhat acquired. So it's like going to the gym. If you do enough bicep curls, they will tend to grow in response to that. So things like a diet that consists of a lot of aggressive chewing, constant chewing gum, clenching, grinding, the term we would use is bruxism, can absolutely lead to that over time. And that can put a lot of undue strain on the temporomandibular joint. The reverse of that is true. Yeah. Atrophy simply means kind of withering or a decrease in size of that muscle, which usually also means a decrease in strength. Atrophy doesn't tend to cause as much TMJ dysfunction because it's just not exerting the same forces on that. So hypertrophy would do more of that.
I've heard that if you do chew these like mastic gums, I think Ben Greenfield is famous for chewing mastic gum, and or if you use some of these jaw exercising devices, I've heard that the risk of TMJ dysfunction or irritation is higher if you're opening and closing your jaw at a wide angle, but if you keep it relatively narrow, then it's slightly less. Is there validity to that?
I think so. I think, you know, as that jaw joint opens up, it's basically a ball and socket joint, but also realize that it's not just simply in one dimension. It's able to move within that capsule of that joint. And so opening it up more widely is going to destabilize the joint a bit. And then coming back down together, you're going to have more torsion on where that ball is within the joint. And so I think if you kind of keep the joint relatively closed, and then you're kind of flexing the muscle, it's staying pretty fixed. And keep in mind also, the masseter is not the only muscle that contributes to jaw opening and closure. It's also contributed to by the temporalis muscle, which is what if you do, you know, clench your teeth, you can feel it kind of bulge in the side of your head right here. There's also the medial and lateral pterygoid muscles that kind of contribute from the inner surface. They're attached to your skull base, and they come out to that way. And basically, the temporalis and the masseter do all the closing, the pterygoids more for opening. So
I know when I used to go to the dentist when I was a kid.
You don't go anymore?
Well, when I was a kid, I feel like I'd have to open my jaw so wide that it'd be painful.
Yeah.
My brother is a dentist. We've had him on the podcast as well.
Sure.
And he is great at doing everything, including general dental hygiene stuff. So he helps me a lot with that. But I always remind him, you know, when you have people open the mouth of the dentist, because I mean, it's a common complaint I get among patients.
Sure.
I went to the dentist and now my TMJ joint is extremely inflamed. Is when they say open wide, it might not mean 100%. Maybe it means something like 97%.
Yeah.
So that's something that I personally experienced, or maybe I'm just being a baby.
No, I think you're onto something there. I think it's just you can overuse a joint just like anywhere in your body. There's also people who have very lax joints. And so that ball and socket, the ball of it can actually become dislocated in some people. And it's sliding over this ledge that's on the front surface.
Yeah.
Some people are able to reduce their own jaw joint back into position just with kind of either just moving it or just kind of touching. But in some instances, it can become completely dislocated.
Yeah.
And that usually requires very forceful manipulation back into place. I've had to do it multiple times throughout the course of my residency training in ear, nose, and throat.
Yeah.
I can assure you that it is not something that looks very fun. And it does usually require some temporary sedation.
Some ketamine.
And, ketamine and propofol to allow someone to relax enough for those muscles to be relaxed so you can manipulate it back into position. And it is an aggressive maneuver.
Yikes. So, well, I'll try not to think about that. We've touched on a lot of more fun topics today.
Yeah.
Is there a, you know, a top top takeaway or high yield takeaways that that we could say for the average person, these are good actionable items that you can implement?
Absolutely. I think you need to be honest with yourself about a budget, because all of this stuff does cost some money in regards to the aesthetic perspective. So I think you do need to kind of determine what you think a reasonable budget is, whether that's weekly, monthly, annually, that's up to the person. But I absolutely think that the daily regimen for a young person of good cleaning, good moisturization, hot, you know, at least 30 SPF for daily usage of sunscreen, hyaluronic acid serums, retinols, and usually something like a vitamin C supplement serum is very worthwhile. And consistency is key. My wife got on retinol, hyaluronic acid, and the hyaluronic acid she uses is the CeraVe brand. It is available at Target or Amazon. I prescribed her her retinol. It's not the lowest percentage, but it's not the highest either.
Like 0.015 or something?
Yeah. So that's kind of the middle one. And then she just has a good, gentle cleanser. I can't remember. It might even be Cetaphil. You know, CeraVe is kind of sibling. It's a very simple regimen.
Cleansers are pretty cheap.
They are.
Yeah,
those are.
$20 for a cleanser that'll last you 3 or 4 months.
And the retinol, specifically, it's tretinoin that I have given her. She actually just asked me for a refill the other day, and it's been 10 months. Mm-hmm. So one little tube lasted her 10 months.
Yep.
And it'll probably be $50 or $70 to refill that. It's not crazy.
Yeah.
So I think that bang for buck is very worthwhile. And she has said over and over again, only in the last probably month, how much of a difference that she has noted. And that is the same story I hear from so many patients and clients of mine, that consistency is key. Continuing to get some of those neuromodulators in there as well, I think is very important. And then if volume is important to you, you can do things like filler, whatnot. Mm-hmm. But I think the daily routine should not be overlooked. It is so important, and it's a minimal investment of money. It's a little investment of time. You got to remember to do it. But if you do, I think it really pays dividends.
Yeah. Well, that is a wonderful summary. I will make sure to link people to all of your social medias and your websites and whatnot. And we work together a lot. I'm sure that we'll have future things to talk about.
Let's do this again.
Publicly as well.
For sure.
But yeah, as always, thank you for joining us. And thank you to the audience for your time listening. I think we talked for a decent amount of time.
Yeah.
So thank you to those that have got here. Please post any questions or comments for either myself or Dr. Williams.
Thank you.
And we will do a Q&A at some point. As always, may God bless you with health and happiness.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.